Silence. I know. This is what I do at the beginning of every podcast, just to mark my... Just wait.
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Pride Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 62 of Nerd Pride Radio. 62, apparently Sigmund Freud had a huge phobia around the number 62. According to legend, he would avoid hotels that had more than 62 rooms because he was afraid he might get that number. But who knows? They also said he's deathly afraid of ferns, and there's very little supporting evidence for that, too. So, yeah, maybe true, maybe not, but it was the only interesting thing I could find out about 62. It's really a dull number. Sorry. Ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I'm awesome! My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D slash Pathfinder nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd plus. There's like seven other kinds of nerd I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my noggin anymore. Oh, my co-host this week is Eric Stratton, Rush Chairman. He's damn glad to meet you. As you've noticed, my wife is here, and she's not participating, but she can hear me because we're in her classroom. I'm recording very late this week. Sorry about that. But I will get this done tonight, and so if the sound is a little bit off, it's because we're in a different location. Things happen. But I have got all sorts of junk to get to, and hopefully we'll squeeze it all in here. We'll start right off with the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast. That's so much better. This is the time for me when I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I add it to my master list, and the best stuff off that list gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. So straight into that master list. First off, updates. First, this is my very last snake update. I'm pretty sure, because this week I wound up getting 1,316 on snake, which is not a perfect game, but it's just about as close as I'm going to get. I did the calculations on snake, and apparently the thing is 11 rows top to bottom, odd number. 19 rows side to side, also an odd number, which means there are an odd number of squares on this board, which means there is no solid loop that passes through every point on the board, makes a continuous loop, and doesn't cross itself. It just, you can't make that loop. At best, I can come up a perfect game would be 1400. At best, I'm going to be able to make 1393. All right, so 1316 is not bad. That's as close as I'm going to get, because to get any better than that, I'm going to have to master this super fast little squiggle action across the top of the screen. I don't think I can do it. So 1316 is my perfect game. All right. It's really damn close. That's just where I'm going to have to leave it. I'm not that I haven't, been playing since then. I keep picking it up, and I wind up scoring like 700 or 800 most times. And eventually I'll hit another 13 something game. And if I'm really, really lucky, one of those 1300 and something games will wind up being, even better than my 1316. But man, that's going to be months from now. So I'm not going to bother you guys every week. I'm just going to say that, hey, this is as close as I'm going to get on my version of Snake. Although just to depress me, I went out and looked for, there's an animated GIF for the perfect game of Snake. Go out and look it up. Just, perfect Snake game animated GIF. do a Google search for it and watch this thing in action. And it's on a different layout than my board, one that apparently has an even number of squares. And this guy, the way it's played through, I assume it's an actual game. Who knows? Maybe the guy just animated a game that looked like a perfect game. Who knows? But I'm watching the thing zip through, and the kind of super fast squiggle action that he does, and the bizarre leaps and bounds he's willing to take to grab some of these dots, I'm really impressed. It's hypnotic. You could sit there and watch that thing on infinite loop forever. At least I could. Crazy. Also on my updates, my weight is, I'm up 4 pounds from last week. I, you know, excuses. I can make up as many as I want. And I've got some really good excuses, I swear. But, I'm not gonna get into that. It turns out that, look, I was out of town for meetings, and we had these big dinners that we had to go to, and then we went out to, out of town for the pumpkin patch this week. I'm not even gonna explain. We went out of town, and we wound up eating out again, and I was really, really bad about it, but, I mean, ultimately, it's just excuses. So, back on the horse. Let's see how it goes. And then my last update, this just happened like literally 15 minutes ago, as I was driving in here. I am listening to, the Nerdist podcast, which I don't listen to very often. I've got the feed subscribed, and I wind up, if it's someone who I'm interested in, then okay, I'll download that one. Same thing I do with WTF. Same thing I do with a couple other podcasts is I just keep an eye on them. And if there's someone that I just want to hear something about doing an interview, great. I'll pull it down. And this was an interview with Dan Harmon, and it was fascinating, by the way. Chris Hardwick is a great guy. I love listening to him talk. Dan Harmon is fascinating. I love listening to him talk. Put the two of them in a room together, they get along really well. It was really fun. But the most interesting part about it to me, I laughed a lot through this episode, but they had, right towards the end, they get into this discussion about forgetting a name, because Hardwick is trying to remember the name of Heat Vision and Jack. And he can't come up with it, and he can't come up with it. And Harmon, of course, it's his show. He knows exactly what he's getting at. And he sits there and just watches him struggle for a while, and they make some commentary on this. And this is exactly the same thing what I do this. Just one episode ago, two episodes ago, I talked about that blanking out on a word, blanking out on a name, and how frustrating that is. And the kind of thing where, I mean, for me, whenever I get it, I refuse to go look it up. I refuse to go ask somebody. I will work for 2 days straight to power through it and just force myself to remember what it was, because, you know, you have that little mental failing, that little glitch that, oh my God, why can I not remember Eddie Vedder's name? How can I not remember Eddie Vedder's name? That's crazy. Cause you know it, you know you do. And so to give up and have to ask for help or look it up, it's admitting that, oh God, my brain's just broken and I'm never going to fix it. But if I can power through it, if I can just wait it out or force myself to remember, then, oh, all of a sudden, and once I've tricked myself into remembering the name, oh, good, I've repaired my brain. Things are good. I'm not failing at all. It's just a little hiccup. We're all right. And Hardwick and Harmon both are describing this because they're both just a couple years younger than I am. And they're both describing the exact same phenomenon and how they go through the exact same process. That it must be a thing when you get into your 40s, at least as a dude, I guess. I don't know. But that idea of just forgetting something that you absolutely know, you know. And then that refusal to give into it, that desire to power through it, it was just interesting. So anyway, since I had just talked about it and then I just heard someone else validate my exact discussion, I was like, oh, I'm not alone in this. Oh, that's so nice. But enough about the updates. What time is it? Don't know much about history. That's right. That music means it's time for my unnamed history segment. Okay. This is the first thing I've ever actually written a script for in months. So let's see if I can get through this. So I'm sitting in my office this week, and my office mate Yancey asks if I have ever heard of Damon Runyon. I say that I have not. So he begins to play a piece from an old radio show entitled Damon Runyon Theater, about which I will tell you more in a minute. This Damon Runyon, it seems, was a writer from the 40s, who wrote pieces about Depression and Prohibition era New York. His work was somewhat more than a little influential. 20 of his stories became movies, including Guys and Dolls, which was also a play, and a movie called Little Miss Marker, which made Shirley Temple a star. However, I was speaking of the first story by Mr. Runyon that I heard, one about a man called 12-Gun Tweeny. And I can't keep up that voice forever. That's Damon Runyon. That's his style. That's and it's familiar to me. Like I'm hearing it. Yancey has found this, and he is trying to describe it to me. And he plays a little piece of the story, and then we wind up listening to the whole story. And I'm like, God, I know this style. And he says, yeah, it's Runyon-esque. He says, there's other stuff that comes up like this. And it's a New York accent, but it's a guy trying to be really, really proper, someone trying to be hoity-toity. And so he doesn't use any contractions, and he uses some big words that kind of, and some complicated phrasing. And it's never grammatically incorrect. It's not, you know, but it sounds odd. Especially when the kind of stories he's talking about, are, you know, it's usually about gangsters of some sort, or it's usually about people hard on their luck, the poor of New York at the time. It was just fascinating stuff. Absolutely loved it. We listened to grand total, maybe about 6 or 7 of these. There's, I think, 52 of them from the old Damon Runyon Theater that are available for free out on the internet. I don't know where he's getting them from, but I'm fascinated by him. He has them playing in the office while we're working, and they're hypnotic. And it was just, they're cool because I don't know how often you listen to old classic radio programs, because I do occasionally, especially when I had satellite radio. There's a whole classic radio station, and classic radio programs are occasionally interesting, but most of them, the point is kind of lost on me. They're so old fashioned, and the motivations of people from the 40s and 50s just don't ring true with me anymore. That we're not concerned about the same sort of stuff. And also because of, you know, everything seems so simplistic and so, you know, they skirt around any issue of sex, and they skirt around. It just seems weird. And so I don't really enjoy those very much, but these, man, thoroughly enjoyed them. Had a great time listening to them. And these are feel good stories. Almost every one of them ends with, cause there's lots of mobsters, lots of criminals, and, almost always the story ends with the little guy triumphing over the bad guys. That's just how it is. And usually through some clever ruse or something. It's a very Brer Rabbit sort of thing that, you know, his cleverness wins out over their muscle and their power and connections and all of this. And some clever thing, some trick winds up winning the day for the little guy. And very inspiring. I mean, I can see why, especially, you know, Depression era, Prohibition era, stuff. I can see why this would be, really popular at the time. And again, you know, they made 20 movies out of this guy's stuff. So, I mean, like this story, about 12 Gun Tweenie. I don't remember if that's the actual name of the story, but it's our usual narrator, Broadway, is talking about, running into this guy, this little nebbish nothing guy. He's an accountant from Ohio or something like that, but he goes by the name of Tweenie. And Tweenie is all upset because, his girlfriend left him for someone who was tougher. And so Tweenie wants to be a tough guy, or at least he's come to New York and he's hoping to meet some tough guys. He wants to meet, some criminals, some tough guys, some shady characters, so that when he goes back to Ohio, he'll have these stories and he can impress people and maybe win his girl back. And all of that seems a little, you know, that kind of motivation that, if I can just pretend to be a tough guy, then my girl will. It's very simplistic Popeye olive oil kind of stuff. But the story itself was just fascinating because what happens is he winds up meeting some of these tough guys, although none of them will admit that they're actually gangsters. And so he thinks he hasn't accomplished anything because none of these guys will admit to being made dudes. And so, he winds up eventually, he's so exhausted by this whole journey, he falls asleep in the bar. And then the cops come around, and then all the mobsters wind up hiding their guns on the sleeping dude because, oh, come on, look, he's a nerd accountant from Ohio, and nobody's going to check him. So the cops come in, they search the place, they search the mobsters, they find nothing, until finally this poor sleeping dude falls over and guns go spilling out all over the floor, and he winds up getting himself arrested, and they take him to court, and the whole thing winds up being this whole comedy of errors as this poor little nerd accountant winds up getting dragged into court, and he's accused of being the world's greatest mobster. And of course, things work out in the end, and he winds up being all right in the end. But the whole reputation thing follows him back, and his girl comes back to him, and everyone lives happily ever after. And then there's a couple of twists at the end to kind of stick it to the mobsters, and it's just cool stuff. But I'm just, again, the idea that this guy wrote so much stuff, short stories and radio plays and all sorts of stuff, and it's been, I mean, again, turned into to plays and movies and musicals and all sorts of stuff. And somehow the name Damon Runyon has never clicked with me. I've never known a thing about him. I mean, like I say, so much so that, I mean, he was so influential at the time that, again, his name became an adjective. You know, things were described as Runyon-esque when you used that sort of, that sort of proper tone to work on stories about, you know, but it's very distinctive. And so I thought I would share it with you guys. If you get a chance, go out and look up some of these old Damon Runyon theater episodes and take a listen to them. It's just, and again, once you start listening to them, that voice, Yancey and I found ourselves, people would come into the office and we would just start talking that, you know, no contractions, doing that very proper thing. And most people would realize that something was going on, but have no idea what it was. It's such an easy thing to fall into. You kind of have to kick yourself to make yourself stop doing it. I don't know if I have more of a point than that, but look up Damon Runyon, listen to some of these, entertain yourself, get two or three of them under your belt, and just have a good time with them. They're cool. Okay, but now it's time to visit my gaming table. I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die. Role-playing games, video games, card games, if it fits on my gaming table, then I am here to share it with you. First off, an update on my moral dilemma from last week. I was wondering how to handle my kids in our Pathfinder game, because we're in a situation where the older child is the one playing the evil character, and it is becoming really easy for him to talk the other kids into doing something evil and thinking it's a good idea, even though they're not playing evil characters. And so I did exactly what I told you guys I would do. I went to my 11-year-old, and I kind of just talked to him about what kind of character he has and what what his character thinks of certain kinds of actions and how he would react if this happened or how he would react if that happened. And he's not a dumb kid, and it didn't take him but a few of these questions to finally realize exactly where I was going with this. And he's like, okay, but you know, seriously, I mean, if we need the money, we get, I'm like, really? Is that what your character thinks? Is that it's okay to stand idly by and let someone go murder an innocent person for money? Well, no, I wouldn't do that. But, oh, all right. Well, I'm just saying maybe you should think about that. And so he thought about it. And when we got to the game, he put his foot down and said, we can't do this. We can't do this. This is not going to happen. I can't let you. And so, the goblin, the evil character, gave in, and he said, all right, fine. His loyalty to his friends was more important than this chance of making new money. And so they confronted the goblin team and said, look, we like you, we want to hang out with you, but I can't do this, I'm sorry. And so then we get an altercation with them, and they wind up, he winds up bribing them eventually to just kind of, look, let's still be friends. Let's hang out. I'll give you a little bit of cash. You guys can save face and pretend this never happened. And okay. So we did that. I was actually surprised at how it all went down. And then they said, but you know, if that's the way it's going to be, then you know, maybe you can hook up with us later. But for right now, you're going to have to go. You guys. And so, all right, fine. We're leaving town. We're gone. And then on their way out of town, they didn't realize, since they were smuggled in the back of a carnival wagon, they did not realize the kind of paperwork that this town requires. They're sticklers for the law with paperwork in triplicate, and you know, foreigners are not welcome unless they've got specific cause to be in town, blah blah blah. And so on their way out, they wind up getting hassle from the guards because they can't leave town until they can start, you know, declaring what it was that they were here in town for and what kind of money they made, what sort of activities they engaged in. Oh, you were circus performers. Well, if you actually wound up doing business here in town, then we're going to have to take a cut of that. For some reason, it didn't occur to him to just bribe this guard. And so they wound up getting the rest of the city guard called on them, and there's people bearing down, and the sorcerer wound up using the last fireball out of his wand of fireballs and blew away the opposition, And then at the same time, he set half the town on fire, and they left in the midst of huge destruction. And so, as it turns out, because he didn't want to allow them to commit the one murder for their own profit, instead they wound up losing money and killing a bunch of people accidentally and setting the whole town on fire, and then making their way out. So maybe still not the right moral lesson, but it was an awful lot of fun to play out. So, these murders were not really, it was self-defense, right? They were defending themselves against, legal members of law enforcement who were just doing their jobs, but still, they were just defending themselves. All right. I'm going to find a way to defend this. I will justify this. I will. They didn't mean to kill. They didn't mean to kill so many people. Does that make it better? Is that all right? I'm just going to back out of this before I get any deeper in. I also told you I was going to check out Strands of Fate. And, I've kind of lost my train of thought of where I was with that. I got really deep into, I read a bunch of the book. It's a huge book. It's like 400 and something pages. I read a bunch of Strands of Fate, which is a version of Fate, a universal gaming system for RPGs in any setting. And holy cow, if the thing isn't really pretty solidly universal, that 400 and something pages pays off, because they, I sat down and said, okay, here's the game I want to run. I want to create a setting in which, it's a transhuman setting, very far future sci-fi. So I want to include, but now we've hit hard times after the solar system wide apocalypse that has reduced us to a lesser technology, and we're building back up and blah, blah, blah. And so I want to have some cybernetics in there, and I want to have some genetic engineering to have some alternate, races of man available. And I want to do, a bunch of stuff with this. And as it turns out, Strands of Fate actually accommodated all of that stuff. I mean, it's not even like I had to do a whole lot of customization. I'm just looking through the book going, okay, yeah, no. We would set it at a tech level 5 or 6. And I'd pick out these options and these options. And yeah, pretty much everything just kind of works. It was really, just really slick. And so, but like I said, I got super deep into it. Now, I've had some other things distract me, and it's been almost a week and I haven't had a chance to get back to it yet, but I'm really excited about it. I'm excited about this world. I'm excited about this possible game. I'm excited about using Strands of Fate for it, if I can convince everyone else to do it, or potentially maybe I don't have to convince everybody else. Maybe if I just set the world up and say I'm going to be the game master, I can do whatever I want. So that would be kind of cool too. But I will have more on that, later. And, oh my God, I put my notes in the wrong order. Back up to my history, just for a second. History! One of the other things that came out of those Damon Runyon stories is there was a drink that he mentioned. It was in a Christmas episode, in fact. And he mentions serving a guy who comes in. He serves him a Tom and Jerry. And I had to look up what a Tom and Jerry was, and apparently it's a variant of eggnog that has rum in it, and a popular drink at the time. And so I thought to myself, what came first, Tom and Jerry the drink or Tom and Jerry the cartoon? How old is Tom and Jerry? Because I'm pretty sure these stories were written before the cartoons came out. I'm really pretty sure of that, but maybe not. Who knows? And so I went and I looked him up, and it turns out that the drink came first, and the drink came first by more than a lot. I mean, Tom and Jerry first started, I think, in the late 40s or early 50s, something like that. And before them was another cartoon, an animated series, about characters named Tom and Jerry, but they were more of a Mutt and Jeff. They were like hobos or whatever. They were bums. And Tom and Jerry, were the main characters there. So this Tom and Jerry, okay, so I'm thinking, were these guys named after the drink or not? They may have been. The drink came first. The drink actually came. Tom and Jerry created in 1940. There you go. Tom and Jerry created in 1940, says my wife, who has Google in front of her that I don't know how to use. as it turns out, the original drink, the Tom and Jerry, the eggnog variant, was created in 1821, created by a guy named Egan, who, hold on just a second, let me look that one up, because apparently Google's going to be required here. Ah, here we go. The guy's name was Pierce Egan, and in 1821 in England, he published a book entitled, I kid you not, Life in London, or The Day and Night Scenes of Jerry Hawthorne Esquire and His Elegant Friend Corinthian Tom, accompanied by Bob Logic the Oxonian, in their rambles and sprees through the metropolis. That was the name of the book. This was adapted by Egan into a stage play called Tom and Jerry or Life in London. Shortened it down. And so that's where Tom and Jerry comes from. And this was actually a play intended to highlight all the various characters of London, the social scene of London, from the king and the richest of nobility and royalty all the way down to the poor and everything in between. And it was really popular. All right, the book took off, the play took off. He was publishing this book all the way through that century. It was adapted to the stage five times throughout the next 100 years. Got carried over to America, where it became highly popular, and thus carrying over the idea. And these two characters are kind of on the low end of things, and so that carries over to Tom and Jerry, the animated cartoon of the two roustabouts, Tom and Jerry. And then also to the cat and mouse that we all know, Tom and Jerry. The reason for the drink, this is where it all originally comes back, is that when Egan put on the stage play, he had just published the book. Within the same year, he's got the stage play going on, and it was a promotional tool. He wanted something to kind of bring people in, and so he invented a drink called the Tom and Jerry, named it after his own book and his own play, invented a drink called the Tom and Jerry. It was towards the Christmas season, so he used the eggnog. It's basically a hot rum drink. And so he used that to bring patrons in to get them to see the play. And it worked. And 100 years later, we've got Damon Runyon still writing about the Tom and Jerry. The drink was still a popular drink. 100 years later in America, the name Tom and Jerry has stuck and carried over to other stuff. I just thought it was fascinating. I mean, who knew the cat and mouse had such an illustrious background, an illustrious history like that? I found that fascinating. But again, that was the history segment. I should have done that earlier, but I put my Tom and Jerry notes. I've copy-pasted them down below the gaming table for some stupid reason. That's just me. All right, let me get my page back up and see where I was supposed to have left off here. Okay, I'm done with gaming. Next up is my Nerd Pride book report. Hey, weird. I actually read a book. Okay. I read The Maze Runner. And my wife read The Maze Runner, and she really liked it. And so she tells me I should read The Maze Runner because she'd like to go see the movie, but she doesn't want to see the movie until we've both read the book. Turns out that was her mistake, because I started reading the book, and I got a few chapters in, and I was really liking it. And then we went and saw the movie. And the movie is quite different from the book in a lot of details, and especially in how it ends and how they solve things. And throughout the movie, we both enjoyed it, but I enjoyed it way more than she did. I thought the movie was, it's not, we're not talking about, groundbreaking, earth-shaking sorts of cinema here. This was not, but it was decent popcorn entertainment. It was fun. I had a good time watching it. It entertained me thoroughly. I was hooked all the way through it. It was really good. My wife also enjoyed it, but she also spent a lot of times audibly rolling her eyes. And she would keep looking at me with her eyes rolling, shaking her head, clearly indicating that this is not how it was supposed to happen at all. Oh, the book was so much better. Oh. All right. And so while she claims to have enjoyed it, she didn't enjoy it nearly as much as I did. Well, then, after finishing watching the movie, I then went and finished the book, which is, it's a young adult novel. It's not like it takes that long. And I love the book. The book was way better than the movie. I'm so glad that I saw the movie first and could have a chance to enjoy it a little bit, and then read the book and go, oh yeah, no, that's how they should have done it. That's way better. And I'm not going to give you a whole lot of detail about it. I mean, look, this is a seemingly futuristic setting, but maybe not that futuristic. It doesn't make it really clear at the beginning, but we have a group of teenage boys trapped in a huge maze. They're in a glade at the center of the maze. They don't know how they got there. They don't know who they are or why they were put here, but in a very Lord of the Flies sort of fashion, they have to survive here. And every day they send out runners to try and explore the maze and try and find a way to escape this prison, essentially, that they're in. And it's fascinating how it's set up. It's absolutely fascinating. And I'm not going to give away anything more than that. It's worth a read. You should really check it out. I mean, come on. You can afford 8 hours of your time to go read a book like this, right? I haven't gotten to book two yet, but I will be doing that soon. But the interesting part about it for me is, hold on 2 seconds. See, I should have just let her talk, but she doesn't want to be on the podcast. My wife, who is listening in from over there while she's working, is wanting me to assure you guys that, look, this is not great literature. This is really not. This is, you know, neither one of us is saying that this is great writing because, oh, by the way, it's not. This is, in fact, really bad writing in a lot of ways, because you know how you can tell that he's mad? Because the book says he was mad. I mean, that's it. It's a, when, you know, show not tell. Nope, never learned that lesson. It will just tell you flat out that, oh yeah, he was really frustrated. He doesn't know if he's ever been this frustrated in his life. He doesn't, I mean, it just spells it all out for you. This is not Shakespeare. But it doesn't matter because the story itself is fascinating. The world that they've created, the science fiction setup of it, this whole concept of the maze, why they're there, the puzzles that are behind it, kind of like Lost. I mean, you're put into a bizarre situation and you've got to just follow the clues and try and figure out what's going on. That mystery and the action that surrounds it is gripping enough for me that I don't even care that the writing sucks. That's not even the point. The story just caught me and held me. And lest you think that there's something lesser about it because of the crappy writing. I mean, come on. Let's all be honest with ourselves. You read Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, right? You had to have. All right. That was crappy writing. Isaac Asimov was not a flowery writer. He did not, especially Foundation, did not, there was barely an adjective to be had. He doesn't, you know, he's not flowery. He's not prosaic. He's telling you a fascinating story, and he's giving you the exact facts of that story, beginning to end, and it was gripping. I love Foundation. I've read it like 3 times. I think that whole series is spectacular. But it was not good writing, but it was a good story, all right? And I guess maybe I should somewhat come up with some sort of qualification as to what qualifies as good writing, because I guess if I like the story and I can't put it down, whether we think it's flowery enough or whether we think it's descriptive enough or clever enough or however we categorize stuff, the fact that I couldn't put it down means that in some sense it had to be good writing, right? Maybe? I don't know. Or another comparison, and this is not a guy that I enjoy on a regular basis, but... No, that is not... This has nothing to do with sucking up to my wife. You stay out of it. John Grisham. Is that his name? John Grisham? Grisham, anyway. Who wrote The Client. And The Client was a big movie with Tom Cruise 20-something years ago. And I read The Client at the time that the movie came out. And I wound up not caring much for the movie, ultimately. And I read the book, and then in the end, I wasn't terribly... It's not really my style of stuff. But one of the first things I noticed about Grisham, at least in The Client, I haven't read any of his other stuff, is... It's that same sort of no-frills writing style of it's not, I mean, it is fact, 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 boom, boom, boom. It just moves through the story at a lightning pace and things happen quick and the action is gripping, but again, not flowery in any way, not, I mean, he doesn't take a whole chapter to tell you something that he could easily give you in 2 sentences. And so he just gives you the facts and goes straight through the story. And again, I'm not saying that I care much for Grisham necessarily. I remember reading the book. I remember not being able to put it down at the time, but then I didn't like it enough to read anything else that he ever wrote. So, you know, for whatever that's worth. But Grisham's novels have sold millions of copies, bestsellers. He writes them specifically to be made into movies, and they all get made into movies. This is a popular work, popular style. And again, the lesson for me is, Yeah, you know what? I don't have to be as clever as I think I have to be when I write something. I mean, I've got a couple ideas in my head for young adult novels that I've wanted to write for years, and I just keep putting them off and never getting to them because I've never written a novel before, and I really just need to get off my ass and do it. And it's things like this, especially The Maze Runner, where I'm looking at going, okay, no, I have a gripping concept. I have good ideas. You know, if I don't have to worry about, you know, the exact right word phrasing or choice or whatever. I don't have to worry about dressing it all up and padding it out. I mean, if I can just tell the story and get it out there, that's good enough, right? I mean, at least for a first shot, let's get it on paper or, you know, in Word at least. And that doesn't mean I'm necessarily going to write it. But it is encouraging to go, look, this isn't great writing. This isn't great. Hell, for all I know, I think Maze Runner is one of those that's been written by committee, that they're hiring grad students. Someone comes up with this great story, and then they hire a bunch of grad students to write the different sections of the novel, put it all together, and crank it out. For all I know, Maze Runner is one of those. And yet, the story is powerful enough that the writing isn't all that important to it. So, anyway, I highly recommend. Read Maze Runner. It's fun. It is worth your time. That's my book report. And I guess movie review at the same time. Let's see. If only I had a taller computer, I wouldn't have to do all this scrolling up and down, would I? There we go. Okay, Grisham's the Client, Asimov's Foundation. See, I didn't even have to look at those notes. I knew what I was talking about. But that's the end of the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast, which leads me to the... Come on, you know it. Say it with me. Pod-o-matic! All right, I mean, that was brief. You could have done something more dramatic for that. Hot dog! This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that is where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? You send your question or topic to me by email, or, better yet, in a private message on our forums, or, you could send it to me on Roll20 during a drunken party last night. Eli, thanks. And I will add it to my Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. Weird. I logged onto my computer last night, forgot that I still had Roll20 open. Roll20 is the software that we use to play Pathfinder every week. Forgot I still had Roll20 open, and all of a sudden my computer starts beeping at me. And so I go look, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm still logged in. Wait a minute, why is Eli in there? And Jeff, why is Jeff in there? So I wind up chatting with them a little bit, and then as we're all just kind of sitting around talking, and it becomes clear that Eli's been drinking a little, then suddenly Lucy shows up, and Lucy is also drunk. And so we wound up continuing the party into about 2 in the morning or so, and we just sat around chatting for, I mean, here we are using our gaming tabletop software to just have a little online chat, but we turned the cameras on, and we all talked and had a good time, and at some point, Eli chewed me out for losing his Pod-O-Matic entries when my computer crashed, and so I told him to resend them. So instead of just forwarding the message back to me, no, he copied them one at a time and posted them into the role-playing chat. But I got them. They're here. Hopefully one of them turns up. Oh, and new guy or gal, but I think new guy, showed up, sent me an email, sent me a whole bunch of new Pod-O-Matic questions. Humongous is his name. And so I'm excited about that. I hope I get some stuff either by Eli or Humongous or both today, because that would be kind of cool, since I feel really bad, especially for Eli, for losing his stuff. I mean, here he went to all the work of sending me these questions, and then I don't bother to get to any of them because I just lost them. So sad on me, but let's see where R2 has left us. He's given us a 35, which, look at that. I have the spreadsheet ready. We're good. That is from Kyle. Kyle says, The Dungeons and Dragons monster, the Lamia, was totally lame-mia, right? Boo. Hiss. You know what? The Lamia is just not one I have a whole lot of use for. I've put a Lamia into my games before, but it's not an easy creature to use because it comes in this huge bestial form that the picture that's usually in the book is a giant lion-bodied centaur woman. And there's other animal forms that she can have, but that's the one that's in the picture. And so you're supposed to have this half woman, half beast, giant thing. Oh, wait, but she works mostly on charm and deception and political maneuvering. So really, most of the time you see her, she's going to be shape changed into something else. And it's not a, I don't know, it's not a convenient monster for me to use. So yeah, you know what? Lamia is probably right. I'll give you that one, Kyle. Number 75. Let me go ahead and label this first one before I forget. All right, 75 is from somebody named Talvin. All right. Talvin says, we know you like fantasy role-playing and future sci-fi, example, paranoia role-playing. What are your thoughts on RPGs set in the modern era? I don't know. I'm trying to think if I've ever played anything set in the modern era. Okay, I did play a little bit of Top Secret and a little bit of 007 way, way back in the day. I mean, we're talking 30 years ago when we first started gaming. And not as good. Oh, hold on. Oh, God darn it. My wife is right. Yes, Pariah, the game I wrote, was set modern day. So, yeah, I forget. Superhero games in general. Psychic. Yeah, you know what? Oh, I have no problem with those. I play superhero games a lot, or at least I have in the past. Mutants and Masterminds, Champions, Villains and Vigilantes even, and of course, my own game, Pariah, which I wrote and published 15 years ago, and, I love those games. And Pariah is, Pariah doesn't ever say superheroes, but it's a superhero game. Yeah, I can do that. Superpowers are awesome.
If there were superheroes, that would have made it a lot easier.
My wife played in the game. It's a game of kids with psychic powers being trapped in an institution and trying to make their escape. And she never put it together that they were actually superheroes. Yeah, you were X-Men. You were like X-Men, New Mutants kind of kids who had been, anyway. Okay. Wow, what a sweet surprise for her. Yeah, I've done a lot of those, and the spy games, the two that the Top Secret and the 007 I was talking about, yeah, I never did like spy genre games. I was no good at those. But there's, I don't know. I've seen lots of games that have, like the Dresden Files game. That's a modern era with magic and witchcraft and all of that. I've never played it, but it looks fascinating. I mean, it's also written, I think it's a Fate game or a Fudge game of some sort. I think it's Fate. I can't remember. Anyway, yeah, I got no problem with modern era games, I guess. So, yeah, we're cool. 65. Apparently everything has to end with a 5 today. That die is probably stuck. Hey, it's from Humongous. All right. I don't even have to cheat to pull up one from him. Humongous says, do you think Blade Runner still holds up? No. No, I really don't. I remember seeing Blade Runner when I was a kid in high school, and I liked it a lot at the time, and I held it up as this iconic thing in my head. And then, about 3 years ago, I decided that Netflix streaming had the director's cut. I'd never seen the director's cut, and that's supposed to be pretty good. So I would watch the director's cut of Blade Runner. Because, hey, this is awesome. And then maybe if it's really good, I'll share it with my kids, and this is this piece of classic sci-fi cinema that I should really, culturally speaking, should share with my children. And it turns out that, I hated it. I mean, it was just, maybe it's something about the pacing. Maybe I've been spoiled. I mean, it's a slow movie. It is a slow movie. I just didn't, I get it, and I understand why it's a classic and why it was so great in its day, because I remember loving it when I was 16 years old. But now, I don't know. It's the whole genre has been done to death in lots of different ways, and it just doesn't feel that powerful. And the thing that made me sad about it is watching Blade Runner again recently reminded me of the first time I saw 2001 Space Odyssey. All right. I don't know what you think about 2001, but I hated that movie the first time I saw it. I saw it in the mid 90s for the first time. And I fell asleep. Those long space ballet, those poetic classical music in the background, ships turning and spinning and locking and, oh, boring.
It was horrifying. And I get that back in the day, I mean, these were spectacular special effects. No one had ever seen the like of them before. We were showing us some really amazing stuff. But I got video games more detailed and with better graphics than that. It just didn't do anything for me. I found 2001 to be really long and drawn out, and Kubrick was way too in love with those space shots and way too in love with these certain angles and takes that it just didn't work for me. I hated 2001. And pardon me, watching Blade Runner for the second time was a lot like that for me. It just felt just too drawn out. There's way too much focus on stuff that just wasn't that meaningful, wasn't that powerful. I just didn't enjoy it. So no, I'm sorry, Humongous. Blade Runner just does not hold up for me. Other people still love it and can still argue over which is the best version of it and the meanings of it and all this. No, for me, I got nothing on that. I'm sorry. Not working. And R2 gives us a number 12. This one is also from my brother Kyle. Hey, Kyle. Kyle says, if you have to choose one, would you rather be a world-renowned poet that knowingly only creates pandering, sappy garbage, or a completely unrecognized author of a novel that is brilliant? That's really tough. Because they're both so appealing. I mean, they really, really are. And I understand your point of view, because my brother Kyle has written a novel that is really, really good and completely unrecognized, and he's certainly not making any money off of this thing. But it's really, really good. And I'm sure a part of him would love to have that opportunity to sell out, wouldn't you? So, by the way, if I've never mentioned it enough, look up Kyle Jones, Norn's Quest. It's on Amazon. It's PDF. I don't remember if he's giving it away free now or if it's just a couple bucks or whatever it is. But it's worth your time. You want to read this book. This book is awesome. And it is, if you go get it now, that's book one. Book two is finished, and I haven't read it yet because I don't think he's released it yet, but it'll be any day now, and we'll all have a chance to read that one coming up soon. And then, of course, he'll wrap it up. He's got a book three that's in the works. So very, very exciting. But back to your original question. I have to pick one, and I know I have to pick one, and I don't want to. But if I become the world-renowned poet, the pandering, sappy, garbage-inspired poet, but I get all my fame and my money, can I then use all that fame and money to then sit down and write something that I think is brilliant or something that at least is more meaningful for me? Because if I could make the money and it could give me the leisure time to do more creative work that I enjoy, I think I'd be good with that. I mean, because we're talking about, although when you say world-renowned poet, ooh, see, you specifically said poet, which means there's not a whole lot of money involved in that. But world-renowned, oh, man. Or do I want to write that one brilliant novel? You know what? I am going to be really, really shallow, and I am going to go with the world-renowned. I'm going to go with the fame and hopefully the cash that goes with it, and then I will use that to create a better life for my family and my children. And then I will use the free time that comes with it to play more role-playing games, because that's really where my passion is, right? Yeah, that's my plan. I'm shallow. 67. 67 is... Hey, from Ronster. Ronster says, have you ever created a race for D&D or some other RPG? I have created so many. Of course I have. Some of them I think I've talked about. I probably, see, you submit the question before you heard me talk about orcs last time, so this is really unfair to you. But yes, I created a variant of orcs, for my Ulok campaign that I loved. I have created other races. I wish I could remember the first time I created a race. I'm sure that, there was a game, Space Ace, when I was a kid. And Space Ace was not a good game, but it did have mechanics for creating your own races and coming up with some new and interesting stuff. And we did, I think it was Space Ace. I don't remember. And I know we did that. And I can't remember any of the things that we created out of it. I've created all sorts of stuff. Mostly The ones that stand out in my mind are the ones from my Ulok setting, and I wish I could remember all of them because they were just, I was so in love with them. The Ulok setting, again, it was just a setting for me to create mashups of D&D races and monsters, and for me to apply all of the templates and stuff that came out of all the different books for D&D 3.5. And so I put together, again, a race of two-headed gnomes that occasionally had a rare genetic twist that they could breathe fire and had all sorts of fire powers. I had the half-celestial halflings that occasionally displayed beast aspects, like the Gardenelles from, you'd have to know D&D and Pathfinder, I suppose, but the neutral good celestial beings that all have beast aspects. There's the wolf version and the horse version and the bird version, whatever they are. And so I had these halflings that were connected to that and would occasionally have these shape changer abilities. Some dwarves with, they were blue skinned dwarves with devil blood, and they ran the gambling section of town. And there were, I mean, there's so many. I mean, just opening the book on races and stuff and applying these different templates, the insectile halfling, I had a new, she was beautiful. Insectile halfling thief, that I ran that we intended to be part of this group, and it never did pan out, but it was really cool. Also, for my cousin Rob, I specifically created a race of half bugbear, half minotaur, because I knew that would appeal to him. That would be exactly the sort of thing that Rob would want to play. And sure enough, he was so thrilled with this concept. It was gorgeous. I mean, the thing was awesome. I can't remember the name of that one. But yes, I've created bunches of races, mostly for D&D, but for lots of other games too. It's creating worlds and races, and I mean, I've built new classes. I enjoy game design. I really enjoy game design, and I do it a lot. And a lot of times, most of the things I've created, most are for games that I have never actually played. I mean, God's Dice. Why did I should have started with God's Dice. God's Dice is my future. I've mentioned it several times. It's what we're going to base our new Firefly style game off of, that we're going to use playing Strands of Fate. For God's Dice, I created, the Spacers. It's a sci-fi setting where humans have colonized the solar system, and now for our Firefly setting, we've moved a little bit beyond the solar system. And through genetic engineering, I mean, there's a race of Martians who are built to be adapted to the ecology of Mars as it's been terraformed. There's the Spacers, who are essentially orangutans with hands on, basically all four of their limbs end in hands, because when you live in space, who needs feet, right? So I've got the Spacers. I've got the dogs, who were genetically engineered servants, who then later, we had a bunch of crusading do-gooders who decided that the dogs shouldn't be slaves anymore, and they genetically enhanced them to be more intelligent. And it was the Sung, who are Eliahed's favorite race. I'm not even going to tell you about them. Go download my God's Dice document. I have it somewhere out there. I'll put a link to it. Okay, or I won't, but you can find it. You got all sorts of fascinating stuff in there. And yeah, and I created all those races out of mostly whole cloth, just because this world just inspired me. I still love God's Dice, even 15 years later. So, yes, the answer is yes, I have. 93 is from, a Mr. Zimnipot. And Zimny asks, when the cat's away, the mice will play. Ooh, what do the mice play? Mostly, they play Old Maid, because mice are not very sophisticated when it comes to games. Old Maid, sometimes Go Fish, although they're really, really bored with that one at this point, and sometimes just Slapjack, because mice are goofy like that. You'll notice it's all card games. I don't know why. You would think they'd be into checkers. Doesn't happen. Weird, huh? 58 is, here it is, Stan. Oh, I love the variety. Stan says, Do you play any card games? Hey, speak of the devil. Do you play any card games of the standard 52 deck variety? Not so much as I used to. I mean, I've always been a big fan of solitaire, but then computers kind of ruined solitaire because you go lay out a hand of solitaire with cards and you're like, God, this is so slow. Why does this have to take so long? I'm a big fan of hearts on the computer. But again, I play hearts on the computer and the computer is not that smart when it comes to hearts. And so I'm usually playing to try and gimmick the game. I'm trying to play hearts so that, I can shoot the moon four times in a row. That's always my goal, is to shoot the moon as often as possible, and try and have a perfect game where you shoot the moon four times in a row. So it's everybody else has a score of 104 and you have a score of zero and you win. That's a perfect game, and I've done that twice. Other than that, what other card games do I actually play? I mean, hearts in real life is actually really fun. But I'm trying to, I don't know. I'm sure I'm missing some stuff. I'm looking desperately over at my wife because she plays games with me and she would know what games I play. I mean, we play Munchkin and other card games like that, but these aren't the 52 card variety. So, nah, never mind. She's not helping because she doesn't remember either. Yeah, Munchkin. That's my card game. There you go. Excellent. That is on its corner. Hold on. There we go. 97. 97 is... I missed it. There we go. It's from Ronster. What is your favorite ringtone? A ring. I like it when my phone rings and sounds like a phone. You don't have to. Lots of people have lots of different ringtones, and that's great for me because that means that when my phone rings, I know it's mine. But for some reason, I just really like it when my phone sounds like a phone, which is old-fashioned to say because phones haven't sounded like phones in years. I get that. But that's just, I don't know. That's just what I like. I like a ringing phone. 92. Also from Ronster. Oh, go crazy today, man. Ronster says, what is your desktop background? That's a good question. Let me go look. Oh, it is it's Order of the Stick, and it is a beach scene that Rich was releasing, specifically releasing a bunch of wallpapers, and this is the summer wallpaper, I assume, because previously I've had winter, where they were fighting a snowman, and I've had fall where they're doing a march through the woods and there's all sorts of stuff hidden around them. So this is a Order of the Stick beach scene that is my desktop background. There you go. Good question. 28. 28 is way at the top, so I have to stall. And it is from DM Darks. Hey, Darks. oh, man. Dark says, what is your favorite Beatles album, and what does that tell us about your personality? The first Beatles album I owned was the White Album, and that doesn't answer your question because it's not really my favorite, although it is really good. But I wound up getting a copy of the White Album on an extra long cassette tape someone had copied for me. It didn't have all the songs on it, but it had most of them. And that is where I first fell in love with the Beatles. And then I wound up buying a blue cover. It was a cassette, Best of the Beatles from, and it had the years on it. And I can't remember what the years were, but it included Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane. And I played that thing about to death. I mean, it was, I played it forever. It wound up in my car. My car had the auto reverse function for cassettes. And so it just played that same tape over and over and over for probably a couple months. I listened to it a lot. I loved that. But my favorite Beatles album now, that is really hard for me to say. I'm probably gonna have to say Revolver. There's something about some of the songs on Revolver that they're quirky and they stand out to me. She Said is on there. Taxman is on there. Is Eleanor Rigby from Revolver? I think it is. Anyway, there's something about that era of Beatles. And I like almost every Beatles. I like Love Me Do. Love Me Do is my favorite Beatles song. I love that song. But I like Beatles from most eras. But for some reason, Revolver stands out to me. And what does that say about me? It says I want to be a hipster. It says that I want to be quirky, and I want you to know that I'm not just a Beatles fan, but I'm a Beatles fan who recognizes certain offbeat, off-the-wall kind of stuff, and I want you to recognize that I am a hipster douchebag. That's what that says about my personality. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. But yeah, Revolver is probably my favorite. 82. 82 is from... Oh, God, I missed it. There we go. 82 is from Ronster. Yeah, you win, Ron. We get it. You're good. This is... I don't know what number we're on. Number 11? Number 12? All right. Ronster says, which Lord of the Rings character or characters are you most like? Oh, shoot. When I first read it, I thought it was asking which one I like the most, which is obviously Samwise. But I've talked about Samwise a million times. Which character am I most like? Boy, this is one that might actually take some thought. I am probably most like Frodo, is my guess, in that I have a tough time thinking of myself as the hero. I have a tough time imagining myself. I mean, yeah, I'm pretty egotistical. I'm really full of myself. I get that. But, to put myself in the same class with, one of these grand wizards or one of these spectacular warriors or one of these great tacticians or any of that stuff, or even Bilbo, who, Bilbo is a very comfortable stay-at-home kind of guy who has adventure thrust upon him, and so he rises to the occasion, and it just, I don't know, it feels a little egotistical to put myself in that kind of role, and think myself to be, because what Bilbo winds up doing, especially, boy, as it's being portrayed in the movies, but what Bilbo winds up doing when he rises to the occasion, he makes himself a hero, and he puts himself out there, and that's a lot of bravery. That's more maybe than I can give myself credit for. But then you think Frodo is the hapless guy who is thrust into the limelight, and I don't think he ever really takes on that mantle of hero. I mean, I see Frodo as being really just kind of pushed around by events, that he kind of just takes what comes at him. Is that me being intentionally humble? Is that me being, maybe. But it's the only one I feel comfortable saying. I mean, maybe someone else can give some better feedback into this, but that's really, and I'm not saying I even identify necessarily with Frodo, because I've never really cared much for him as a hero. I don't, as the centerpiece of that book, I don't even know what that says. Cause I mean, honestly, I like Legolas and Gimli and Samwise and even Merry and Pippin. And I like all these characters way better than like Frodo. And you ask me which one I'm most like, and I say Frodo. What does that say about me? But you know what? We did psychoanalysis in the last question. We're not going to do it again this time. So you guys just draw whatever conclusions you want from that. 93. No, 63. Which I still think we might have done that one already. No, we have not. It's Ronster again. I'm actually really just going to keep rolling until I get something that's not Ronster. That's my plan. Fly or take a road trip? What if the flight was free? Okay, well, that actually answers, that directly addresses how I was going to answer the first part of the question. Flying or taking a road trip, I would much rather fly, but I'm going to take a road trip because I don't want to spend the money on flying. Are you out of your mind? But what if the flight was free? Well, yeah, obviously. Look, if the flight's free, I'm definitely going to fly. You got that one right. 57. 57 is, from DM Darks again. And DM Dark says, why is Cyclops, and then he puts in parentheses Scott Summers to make sure I know which Cyclops he's talking about. Why is Cyclops such an asshole? I don't know. I don't know what makes him an asshole. He just is. He's the older brother, which, okay, again, I'm the older brother. What am I saying about myself? He's the older brother. He's the guy who is overly concerned with the rules. He's the lawful good of our good party. He's the stickler. He's the leader. And when you're the leader, you're not there to be liked. I mean, being liked is nice if you're a leader, but it's certainly not required. He's the one that has to make the hard decisions, and he's the one that has to keep everybody else in line. And ultimately, the way that shaped him in the comics is he comes off as a dick, and most people think he is. And in fact, they make the point in the first X-Men movie of having Wolverine prove he is who he says he is by pointing out that Scott's a dick. All right, and we all love that line because that was hysterical. That was maybe the best line in that entire movie. But yeah, I got nothing on that one. After I give you a 5-minute answer, then I go on and say, yeah, I got nothing. I can't. Yeah, no, I have lots of things to say about it. I'm not sure if that's the case. I'm not sure if anything I'm saying is having meaning here, but that's the way I see Scott Summers. I've never cared much for him as a character. Really haven't. Cause he's always been kind of a dick. So there you go. And my hand is reaching for R2, but I'm not going to do it. I think we're done for the day. So all that's left is for GLaDOS to give us a recap.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2014 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. My bumper music this week is Weezer's In the Garage and Wonderful World by Sam Cooke, plus whatever the music was that I used for my book report. I don't know why I don't have it listed here, but it's the book song by They Might Be Giants. I know which song it is. I just can't remember the name. It doesn't matter. All these songs are available on iTunes. You check them out. You buy them. You enjoy them. I wouldn't include them on my podcast if I didn't love them. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes and write me a nice review, which reminds me, I just thought this week, I tell you guys that every week to go over to iTunes and write me a nice review. I've never bothered to check. It just occurred to me that I have never gone into iTunes to see if anyone's actually been writing me reviews, because I don't really care much about my iTunes statistics. I don't care about my rankings because I'm not expecting to be top of any list. But boy, it would be nice to have a nice review. You know what? Hold on. I'm going to pause and go over and check. Let me just see. Wow, that was a bad idea. How depressing. I go over to iTunes and check out my reviews, and there's the 3 reviews that have been sitting there. Since I first started the podcast, nobody has written a review in, 3.5 years. At least I think the one from Non-Random Man, I think, because 2 of them are from friends that I recognize. And then, one of them is a review by a guy named Non-Random Man, who I think is also a friend, but I was trying to look it up on my phone. So, I don't know for sure, but I think that one's been around too. But 7 total ratings, all 5 stars. So clearly I am quality. But I keep asking you guys for reviews for naught. It means nothing. Don't worry. But no, I'll be fine over here. You guys just, you live your lives as long as you're happy, as long as you're having fun. That's all that matters to me. I'm fine. I'll just here in the dark eating wet cigarette butts out of the dirty ashtray. It's okay. Anyway, or instead of that, check out my Facebook page. At facebook.com/nerdprideradio, stop at the Facebook page, click like. It is 9 seconds out of your day. You can do that for a buddy, and many of you have. So that one I can give you credit on. Don't forget to check out the free games I have available on my free games page. Instant Game, Animal Ball, Melee, Sandbox Hill, 2/3 of a dozen others, all free, all the time. If you want to and also, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, my game Pariah, not free, not on my website, but you can get that from roguepublishing.com. Or I think it's out on RPGnow.com. Either way, go out and buy it. It's like $4 or $5. I'll get a couple bucks out of that. Pariah is really cool, really fun game. But if you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com. And I promise I will actually respond to you. But to be totally honest, the very best way to talk to me is to come sign up for my forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. Oh, or my Twitter account @nerdprideradio. But do the private message thing. You sign up there, you send me a message, we will hang out together, we'll be best friends in the world, and we will have fun. All right, guys, it's time for my, I still have a name for this segment. You guys have let me down on this. All right, you know what? Actually, tell you what. help me come up with a name for this segment, because remember not 60 seconds ago when I was trying to guilt trip you about not writing me iTunes reviews? I was kidding about that one. I really don't give a crap about iTunes reviews. Don't even bother. That's not, I mean, you should. I mean, if you want to leave me a nice review, that would be awesome. It would be great for me. But if you don't, I understand. I don't go out writing iTunes reviews of all of my favorite podcasts, even though I really should. And that makes me a hypocrite. So I'm not going to guilt trip you guys on that one. But this one, I need a name for this segment. I mean, otherwise, seriously, if I don't get something by next week, we're going to be stuck with, you know, Mike's Nerd Pride Happy Fun Time Unicorns and Butterfly Podcast segment. I mean, that's all I got, because I can't use unnamed segment because I've already got an unnamed history segment. But this is the part of the show where I read whatever comments people have left for me just during the time I've been recording. Before I start recording, I go out and I let everyone know that I'm recording this episode, and if they want to add anything, here is their chance. You want to give me that big, long, award-winning speech you've been wanting to deliver to the world? Go ahead and post it in there. I'll read it. All right. You want to ask me a question, a Podomatic style, whatever, you go ahead and do it. I am here. If you guys just want to chat with each other and have me sit here like an idiot and just read off your forum chat, I'm happy to do it. This is all good. All right. So to wrap up this segment, let's go see what everyone said. Let's see. I say, I'm recording finally. Have y'all got anything to add? Eli Head says, yay. Well, thank you, Eli. Glad to see you too, man. Lucy says, yeah, I want to know how often you're not wearing pants in any given 24-hour period. Okay, I would guess, I mean, certainly, look, the 8 hours I'm sleeping, and usually a good 2-3 hours before that, I mean, it depends on how early I'm getting ready for bed, and, you know, supper's done, homework's done, getting ready for bed, and then I just watch TV, I talk to you guys on the internet, I do whatever I'm going to do. Spend time with my wife, and then, you know, I sleep. And then, so maybe 8 to 10 hours a day on average, but on a good weekend, if I have a weekend where I don't have to go anywhere and I don't have to do anything, which really does not happen often lately. Oh man, we've been constantly on the move lately. But on a good weekend, I mean, I could go a whole weekend without putting pants on. Nah, that usually doesn't happen. I usually have to run out for something, stop by the store, have to, so probably 24 hours is a pretty long stretch, but yeah, in general, I'd say about a third of my day is pantsless. Maybe sometimes a little bit more than that. To follow that up. Oh, Akiva. Hey, Akiva. I haven't talked to you in a long time. Akiva then follows up by saying, I want to know why Lucy wants to know about your pants wearing situation. Oh, wouldn't you like to know? Yeah, which obviously you would, because that's why you're asking. Because last night, while people were drinking and having a good time on the internet in our little video chat session, I made a joke because they kept asking me to put the camera on because they can't see me. And I don't put the camera on because then it slows my system down and I get all this lag. And finally, I succumbed to peer pressure and I went ahead and turned the camera on. But I told them that it would have to wait just a minute while I went and got some clothes on. And then once I did get there and they could see me, of course, it's just a webcam. They can only see me from the waist up. So I then made reference that, fine, I'll be here and I'll turn the camera on, but you can't make me wear pants. So there you go. That was the whole joke. Was it worth it? I don't know. It was funny at the time, but I guess you had to be there. You should join us next time, Akiva. You would have a great time doing that. I know you've got the Roll20 account. All you have to do is sign up. Just come in and hang in our room. We've got links to it right there in the forum. Just come hang out and you'll be surprised at how often you go into Roll20 and someone's just hanging out in the gaming room by themselves as if they're testing something or waiting to see if other people are going to show. Who knows? It's fun. But that's it. Say goodnight, R2. Okay, quick addendum. I was mistaken. I reported earlier that there were no new iTunes reviews, and I was completely wrong. That was because I was trying to check from my phone. It only gave me the first three listed. I went in and checked. There's more than that. I mean, there's only a couple more, but there's a couple of recent ones. One of them is from Ronster. Thank you, Ron. And the other one is from Rose, and I know who Rose is, so thank you, too. So I just want to make sure that when I left off of this podcast, no one sat here and thought that I had forgotten about them, missed them, didn't notice them. I'm paying attention. I noticed. So there it is. Thanks.